Wage is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and guests and are not necessarily those of the Information Radio Network, its affiliates, stations, or advertisers.
This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views and the views of our guest. And our guest today is Dr. David Ayoub, who is a radiologist who's done some very, very important work on the thimerosal in childhood vaccines, and thimerosal as it's used today in the influenza vaccine, which is given to both pregnant women and very young children and the elderly. What does thimerosal do, and is it toxic? And of course, there's no question it is toxic. And if you have not yet seen the video we offer of Dr. Ayoub's presentation before our conference 2 years ago, and associated with that is a CD-ROM, which actually gives you literally hundreds and hundreds of scientific references on the background of the known toxicity of thimerosal. We recommend that to you. But this evening we're going to be talking about something different. We're going to be talking about the aluminum that is routinely placed in vaccines. And of course you'll hear most doctors say, well, of course I'm totally in favor of vaccines, but, and then they'll talk maybe about the concern about the thimerosal, but nobody wants to talk about the toxic amounts of aluminum that is in every vaccine shot given to every child in this country. And so without further ado, I'm going to let Dr. Ayoub begin to talk about what he has found about aluminum toxicity in our children. And then we wonder why when children get their vaccines, very often they'll have problems. But what we really find is that the children who come to America, come to the United States from other countries, work really often very, very healthy. They're very, very poor countries, but the children are healthy. They come here, they get the vaccines, they start on the diet given to our children, and before long, many of these children are ill. What part do vaccines play? Well, Dr. Ayoub, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thanks, Dr. Stan. It's great to be on again.
Why don't you just pick the story up, and I'll be quiet here.
Well, you know, you're right. I've worked on thimerosal, reviewing the literature in an advocacy role and done some research for about 3 years. And about 6-8 months ago or so, I got emails from parents who I've been in touch with, and I was reviewing some of their toxicology profiles they had on their children with autism, and I kept on noticing that an awful lot of these kids had high levels of aluminum in their testing, no matter whether it was a hair test or a urinary porphyrin test that tested for tissue level metals, or a post chelation profile. And you know, I got to wonder if aluminum could be contributing to some of the features in autism or some of the comorbidity. And I think probably the kicker is when I was visiting a nutritionist here in Southern Illinois, he was a good friend of mine, and he told me he just treated an entire school of middle-aged school kids that are, you know, 8 to 12 years old, who developed ADHD after taking a free Capri Sun drinks every hour for from a local distributor. And so they were drinking this. It turned out it was loaded with aluminum, and they developed ADHD. And it was just sort of a number of converging coincidences, I suppose. And I decided to roll up my sleeves and just take a closer look. But I was really urged on by several of these moms. And if you learn anything in medicine, you listen to the parents. You listen to the patient. And you can learn an awful lot that way. And I did. And the compilation of that work, you know, thus far, I presented at the National Autism Association last month.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Go right ahead, David.
And the title of my talk in Atlanta was Aluminum Vaccines and Autism, Deja Vu. And, and I was a little skeptical when I started looking at the literature, but I've read probably in excess of 1,000 papers on aluminum toxicity, and I'll summarize my opinion, right now. It may very well be that the aluminum in the vaccines is a lot worse than the mercury, and even people in my circles that have been campaigning for safer vaccines, I think were pretty shocked to hear some of the materials and data and figures that I had. Now, we have done a little bit of preliminary research, and so it's not just a literature review and coming up with hypotheses, but we've actually done a retrospective review of over 100 kids, and we have found a very significant high prevalence rate of aluminum retention in these kids, whether it's vaccines alone or other things or something else entirely, don't quite know, but it's a shocking story, and I'm just amazed. And I've got many, many more months of work to do on this, but we certainly have enough, I think, to warn, I think, parents about really being careful by getting aluminum-containing vaccines and trying to spread them out and avoiding some other very common things we're exposed to on a day-to-day basis that have aluminum.
But don't most of the vaccines have aluminum? Isn't that what the alum is all about? Put in there to stimulate the immune system so that the vaccine will work more efficiently?
Well, it is. It's not in all of the vaccines. But it's actually in many of the vaccines that had contained the large amounts of mercury. So then again, that produces somewhat of a confounder. If some of the epidemiology studies that did find an association between mercury-containing shots and autism had aluminum in the same shot, so it could have potentially been a confounder. You will find it in the first 18 months of life. It's given a newborn hepatitis B and the Hep B series, giving the first year of life. It's in the DTP vaccine, the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis. It's in the Haemophilus B. It's in the pneumococcal vaccine, now given to children. Those are 5 shots. It's in the hepatitis A vaccine, given at 12 and 18 months. But what's important, and that's consistent with really considering any toxicological component, is what is the weight-adjusted dose the kids get. That's really the key issue. And when you add this up, what we have is the shots are given in the first 18 months at newborn.
You're going to have to hold that thought. We're going to bring our stations right back on board right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Aob is simply pointing out that aluminum is contained in so many of the vaccines, so many of the childhood vaccines, whether it be the hepatitis B or the Haemophilus or the I'm not going to try to list them, the DPT shots, but in the first few months of life, these children are getting the vaccines certainly has a great deal of aluminum in it. And aluminum is placed into the vaccines routinely. It's been there for many, many years. But the aluminum certainly has toxic qualities. And so David was just saying, when you consider the weight-related relationship between the weight of the child and the amount of aluminum they get, what did you find, David?
Well, this is typical for an average weight child at these intervals. On the days of vaccination, this child will receive between 50 and 250 micrograms per kilogram. In many of those days, for example, 2 months, shots, 5 shots, 250 mics, 4 months, you get 149 mics, 6 months, 157 mics. So, you know, basically you're talking about 100, 150, 200 mic average per day you're getting vaccines. We know what that number means, but how toxic is that, and what are the limits? Has anyone looked at the limits of vaccine aluminum? And that's where the story gets a little strange. Now, this will, by any way you look at this, this is in excess of safety by far. Just as in the case with thimerosal, this is in excess. The FDA actually has a statement of how much they allow in a vaccine per shot, not per weight, not per kid, not per day, but per shot. And they limit 850 mics per vaccine. Now, that's a little bit strange because it's not based on safety testing. They've admitted it's not based on safety testing. It's based on what works in the vaccine as an adjuvant, and you were right. It does boost the immune response. And that's even controversial. It's not needed in all vaccines. Some of the HPV vaccine work that has been done the last couple of years actually showed there's no benefit to adding aluminum to these to this particular vaccine. But so these doses, you know, the FDA, as far as what they regulate for vaccines, not based on safety. So you have to do a little extrapolation work, and we have had a lot of experience with aluminum toxicity from IV solutions, from parenteral nutrition, which is IV solutions for feeding that are given to newborns, for various other solutions. In fact, it contaminates a remarkable number of solutions on the shelves of hospitals. Not necessarily intentionally placed, but it's a contaminant. It's a contaminant of the glass. It's a contaminant of the contents, like calcium-containing contents, amino acids. I mean, in very large. Some of these solutions had 1,000 micrograms per liter, so it was very high. But here is what probably the closest I can get to coming up with a solid statement on toxicity. And this is the work of many years of Dr. Gordon Klein, who's a nephrologist, I think, down at the University of Texas, worked with the American Society of Clinical Nutrition and the American Society of Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition, and they made this statement in 1991. They reviewed all the toxicity cases from IV exposures. And when you get an IV aluminum, you're getting 100% absorption into the body. When you get a vaccine, ultimately 100% is absorbed in the body. So they're similar, not identical exposure routes, but they're similar. The statement they say is that anything above 60 micrograms per kilogram is toxic. I'll repeat that. Anything above 60 mics per kilo is toxic.
But you were just saying that some of these children are getting 125 micrograms at
250.
250, okay.
Yeah. So, and this isn't, there's no margin of error built into this. So what I'm saying is, if you think of vaccine, you know, intramuscular exposure is similar to an IV, and it isn't quite similar, but it's as close as we have, that we would predict that we're going to see extensive toxicity in kids from these levels of aluminum. And this isn't the only statement I found. FDA has said in IV solutions for newborns, aluminum should not exceed 4 to 5 mics per kilo per day. Now, a newborn, 4 to 5, and a newborn today with a Hep B vaccine alone will get 75 mics per kilo per day. Pretty stunning. So, now, there are some values that have been given for oral exposures. It's much more difficult because orally, aluminum is not absorbed very well, and there are some circumstances where it's absorbed, you know, much higher, but typically 0.1 to 0.01% of what's ingested is absorbed through the gut. It's not efficiently taken up in the gut. And if you look at some of the levels of toxicity that are set for the orals and convert it, you have to multiply that, you know, by the percentage of absorption. What they're saying is you will start to see toxic levels at 300 mics per kilo per day. And that's basically, we're right up to that. So there's really no cherry picking here involved. I can't find any statements at all that would make me feel comfortable at these doses, you know, by any means. And if I had to pick a dose, you know, if 60 is toxic and there's generally you want a 10 factor at least built in for safety, you're talking about we should be given kids really 5 to 6 mics per kilo, which is inconsistent with what the FDA says for newborns, and we're multiple fold above that. So, yes, we are given an awful lot of aluminum. Now, that's the first part of the puzzle. I guess the second part of the puzzle is, what is aluminum toxicity? You know, is it you know, substantially different than what we're seeing in our kids today? Then there's probably not an association. But the fact is, it's pretty similar. I could read you the MSDS safety sheet, and that's probably one of the easiest things to do is find somebody who manufactures aluminum powder, aluminum salt, and they're required by law to make a statement for their employees, to let their employees know if you have an exposure at work, you are susceptible to these toxic side effects, and so the workers know and their physicians know. And this is just some of the things that aluminum can do based on a, you know, garden variety MSDS statement. Ingestion, and this is has to do with ingestion in this case, can cause osteomalacia, which is weakening of the bones, microcytic anemia, weakness, fatigue, visual and auditory hallucinations, memory loss, speech and language impairment, and that includes dysarthria, stuttering, stammering, anomia, which is difficulty in naming objects, hypofluency, aphasia, and eventually mutism, which is not speaking at all, epilepsy, grand mal or focal seizures, motor disturbances include tremors, myoclonic jerks, ataxia, convulsions, motor apraxia, muscle fatigue, dementia, personality changes, altered mood, depression, diminished alertness, lethargy, clouding of sensorium, and so on and so forth. Doesn't look, sound like a real benign chemical by any means. So obviously the next thing to do is, if we're talking about autism, we learned a lot about aluminum toxicity in the 80s from, and you might remember this, in individuals who were placed on dialysis. They were given something called phosphate binders, which contained aluminum orally. And they did that because in renal failure, phosphate levels are elevated. And in order to prevent absorption in the gut, to compensate for the kidney's inability to excrete it, they put on fairly high dose of these phosphate binders and acid-like substances. And a lot of them developed Alzheimer's-like dementia. But children got exposed to this, too. So, and I spent just a great amount of time in the libraries finding how many cases of early childhood aluminum exposure has there been, and what are the features of that. And would you believe that I found cumulatively 85 cases in the literature of toxicity in kids? Now, that's pretty interesting because, you know, we don't have nearly that many cases of thimerosal exposure in kids, you know, other than the vaccines and autisms today, but... You know, it would have been nice in when we're doing our detective work on thimerosal is review the early childhood exposures. But there was really very, very few. And most of them were big doses. I think you might remember they were used on surgical wounds and they killed children when it was just rubbed on their surgical wounds. But I found 85 cases. And, boy, if I read you some of these symptoms, you're going to say this sounds an awful lot like autism. And in fact, it really does. This is one of the largest series, and this happens to be children who were in renal failure and given these phosphate binders. It was published in 1982, and there's 20 children in this particular study. 95% of the kids had developmental delay. 75% had a small head or microcephaly. And did you know about 15% of the autistic children have small heads? We think of autistic children typically having big head, but actually about as many have large heads as they do small. Seizures in 65%, and we have a very high comorbidity in autistic kids with seizure abnormalities. 65% have hypotonia. In fact, when you look at all of these reports, very consistent. Children have can't sit up, they can't hold their heads up, and this goes on, you know, well into the second year of life. So there's a real problem with muscle tone. Dyskinesias, abnormal movements. Half of the kids who got CAT scans showed severe cerebral atrophy. Myoclonus, which is involuntary jerks of the arms, and we see this in autism, muscle weakness, diminished lethargy, level of consciousness, and so forth. But in other reports, I'm not going to go through all 85 publications, but another consistent description in these kids was loss of milestones, regression of after normal development, regression of speech. Speech is very prominently described with aluminum toxicity. Loss of motor landmarks, motor problems. And we know that a very large percentage, probably close to 100% of autistic kids have motor abnormalities. And not all of these cases were renal failure patients. fact, some of them were kids, were taking antacids combined with soy formula. The soy formula has an awful lot of aluminum in it. Some do. And in fact, it's not even in the soy plant. It's in the processing of the soy where this aluminum gets introduced. And of course, in the antacids, they contain aluminum. So it isn't just children with renal problems that can't handle aluminum. Children with normal renal function have been reported to have difficulty handling aluminum as well.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment with Dr. David Ahub. Go right ahead, David.
So we were talking about some of the symptoms that we found in these 85 reports, and we're really...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four tape or a four CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
was coming from cooking pans or from other sources. And this was well known all during the last, the previous century. This would be the 18th century, pardon me, the 19th century, that aluminum was a deadly poison and was not, and should not be in the food supply. And David simply talking about, how many people, you know, get exposed to aluminum, they get all sorts of problems with obesity, and you pick up the story there, David.
Well, yeah, I think as I was going through some of the systemic effects of aluminum toxicity, I'm beginning to realize that this may be responsible for more woes in our society than you know, just about anything else right now. I mean, we worry about, and you've spoken so well about things like aspartame and monosodium glutamate and fluoride, and I hate to tell you this, you know, I mean, aluminum needs to go up on that list.
Yeah, well, that's fine. I'm quite willing to put it on the list. I just need the background, and I'm so glad you've done the research on it. Go ahead.
Well, you know, going back to that commission, the Federal Trade Commission report, Dr. Betts did obtain some testimony that has not been released in the official transcript, but I want to quote one sentence made by one of the leading toxicologists in the United States at that time, Dr. Victor Vaughn, at the University of Michigan. And he said this in 1927, all salts of aluminum are poisonous when injected subcutaneously or intravenously. Now, this is about the time they started putting it in vaccines that were to be injected. So, obviously, the historical detective work isn't complete. I am sure there's a really good story here, you know, to try to figure out who Dr. Glennie was, and this is the first guy apparently to use this, and how a poison, you know, out of the blue, fell into a vaccine vat and all of a sudden made the vaccine better. It's just a pretty perplexing story. But the first case of Alzheimer's, in retrospect, may have been published in 1921 in Lancet. It was a very brief report. Dr. Betts cited this in his book. It was a case of a 46-year-old metal worker who was exposed to aluminum on the job, and he developed, quote, a rather slow intoxication. In this case, it caused memory loss, tremor, jerky movements, and incontinence of urine. There was really no follow-up given, but it's an interesting observation that this is not inconsistent with what we see in aging disorders, dementia, Alzheimer's, and so forth. And Dr. Betts also made reference to the nervousness that was developing in all the children that were unable to concentrate and had difficulty in school, all coincident to the introduction of aluminum in the food supply. So, very interesting.
Now, how do we get it in the food supply other than the baking soda?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a contaminant in so many processes. It's probably in literally every single thing you put in your mouth from the kitchen, but baking powder is one of the high ones. Now, we probably ought to go through the list of some of the things that we're all exposed to, not just children, but adults. And I don't know if you've had any guests on in the past that have reviewed the Alzheimer's aluminum connection or not, have you?
No, we really haven't. We've talked about the Alzheimer's mercury connection, but not the Alzheimer's aluminum connection. Although, certainly, you know, 10 years, 20 years ago, people used to talk about it all the time, and we're concerned about, you know, people getting the aluminum. Aluminum apparently is in a lot of antiperspirants, you know, the things that you take so that you will not have smelly armpits. And, and you know, of course, you put the aluminum right on the skin. It's absorbed into the system. A lot of people are concerned that this is one reason why people are getting Alzheimer's disease, along with other exposures to aluminum. But we really haven't talked much about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because my introduction to the topic was from Dr. Boyd Haley when I heard him speak at meetings, and he's probably spoken to you about that, I imagine. That's one of his areas of interest. And I thought the mercury data was pretty significant and pretty strong, but when I looked at the aluminum literature, my goodness, Dr. Stan, I think it's a foregone conclusion that there's a cause and effect. And in fact, if you read the literature, there's a lot of strong statements in the mainstream literature. When you go from science that's published in peer review to what's accepted by the public or physicians, there's a step in there, a big step. And a lot of that has to do with how medical societies deal with science and how journalists deal with science. And that's typically where there's a roadblock. But I think it's an extremely profoundly strong link between aluminum and Alzheimer's. And if you go to PubMed today and type in aluminum and Alzheimer's, you will see that the research hasn't even come near to stopping. They're still doing lots of active work some very strong studies that have been published just in the last year.
What do you think? Do you think it is a combination effect of aluminum and mercury? Do you think it's predominantly aluminum?
Well, you know, when you look at how aluminum acts, actually aluminum is a very strong inhibitor of glutathione production.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. David Aub, and we're talking about aluminum. And David was just saying that aluminum blocks glutathione production. And perhaps for our listeners who don't know too much about glutathione, what is that? We know that that plays a part with mercury. What is glutathione, and why is it important? How is it blocked?
Well, glutathione does a lot of things. With regards to mercury toxicity, it is the chief way in which mercury is eliminated from cells and from the body. Every cell in the body produces glutathione. The liver takes glutathione bound to mercury, excretes it in the bile. So you need glutathione to eliminate mercury effectively. If your glutathione production is impaired, mercury is going to be hanging around. Aluminum impairs basically removal of mercury. So mercury found in autopsies, found in blood, found in the post-provocative urine profiles, you know, in a chelation challenge, in people who have been exposed to aluminum, it may be just along for the ride. It is there in the tissues because of aluminum toxicity. So it's a leap of faith to go and cause and effect. But what's interesting is, and I don't know if you've heard this before, in the Alzheimer's brains, in the pathology that is very specific for Alzheimer's, to diagnose, you know, the tau proteins and the senile plaques and the neurofibrillary tangles, they find aluminum wrapped up inside that pathology. And experimentally in animals, in rabbits, which is the best, I understand the best animal model for Alzheimer's, a similar pathology is seen in rabbit brains. If you inject aluminum in these rabbits, you will produce the pathology of Alzheimer's. And if you chelate these rabbits, the pathology reverses. It goes away. So, you know, I'm not sure what else we need, you know, in scientifically to prove that there is a link or basically a cause and effect relationship. We know everybody's exposed, and there's a number of epidemiology studies just looking at drinking water. The higher the water aluminum content in a community, the higher the dementia and Alzheimer rates. So it's pretty profound, in my opinion. You know, vaccines aside, I think as an adult, no matter what your age, we're hearing about Alzheimer's is going to increase multiple fold in the future, according to experts. Amazing how experts can predict the future, isn't it? But we need to know what it's in, and I think there's some real sleepers in our medicine cabinets that we should keep think about.
What about in our drinking water, where they put the aluminum in the water to make it clear?
Yes, it is added to municipal water supplies.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Aub. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Aub was simply saying that in rabbits, which seems to be a very good model for human Alzheimer's disease, if you give them the aluminum, you'll find that they get the plaques and they get the fibrillation and they get all the changes in the brain. And then if you chelate them and get rid of the aluminum, the whole process reverses itself, and the rabbit's Alzheimer's disease goes away. Well, then, of course, the question comes up, you know, as to what part this is playing as far as human beings is concerned. So we were talking about the fact that there many times in public drinking water, they'll actually add aluminum to the water to get the water clear, and it looks great and clear, but how much aluminum is there? What's the relationship between the aluminum and the rapidly increasing incidence of Alzheimer's disease? You pick the story up, David.
Well, Alzheimer's certainly could be multifactorial, no question about it. And I'm not an Alzheimer's expert per se, but just having spent 6 months in the aluminum literature, you learn a little bit. We're not going to eliminate our exposure to aluminum. It's impossible. You basically have to fast and not breathe the air, basically. I mean, it's in everything. So you really want to be able to reduce the situations where you're going to absorb a lot. And the gut is a pretty good barrier, with the exception of circumstances where the pH of the gut is altered, or you're taking substances which markedly enhance absorption. Very important. Sorbate. Now, have you ever heard the advice from nutritionists not to take vitamin C with meals?
No, I haven't.
A lot of them will tell you that. It's because that vitamin C, the ascorbate, will enhance gut absorption. Gut absorption, normally I said 0.1 to 0.01%. It can go up to 5%. And unfortunately, these pouch drinks, like Capri Sun drinks, the Capri Sun drink that I looked at had three forms of citrate in it. Three forms of citrate in an aluminum pouch. This is the drinks that was given to these children that we're writing this up right now that developed ADHD. It's a very bad idea to drink a citrate drink out of an aluminum can or aluminum foil. There's no question. It's completely illogical. In fact, in the antacid literature, they knew there were fatalities reported decades ago from the combination of citrate in aluminum-containing antacid. And so the pharmaceutical industry knew that they couldn't put citrates with aluminum. The food industry, of course, you know, I guess it doesn't follow those same rules or common sense. So I think it's extremely important when you're drinking juices, your grapefruits, your orange juice, to drink this on an empty stomach, because that can markedly enhance absorption. Now, there's evidence, there's aluminum in toothpaste, there's aluminum in deodorant, and there is evidence that this absorbs systemically. In fact, Chris Exley, who is one of the top aluminum researchers in the United Kingdom, has written a couple of very interesting papers, hypothesis papers, but they did testing in breast tissue biopsy from mastectomies, and they found a substantially higher aluminum concentration in the upper outer quadrant of breast. And they presume that this is due to the use of underarm deodorants that contain aluminum. Now, is aluminum a carcinogen? Well, it's funny, if you go to some of these organizations, there's a couple of organizations that will list. One is NIOSH, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, and they have a carcinogen list. They don't have aluminum on the list. National Toxicology Program has a list of carcinogens for consumers. They don't have aluminum. If you go to the veterinary medicine literature, you will find whole societies on vaccine-induced sarcomas, and mostly in cats. There's over 130 papers published in the veterinary literature proving that vaccines, injection site sarcomas develop, and aluminum is found inside those sarcomas in half the instances. And aluminum goes to the DNA. It is toxic to the DNA. It goes, in fact, the ability to aluminum to get past cells because of its lipophilic properties is amazing. It can pass blood-brain barrier. There's really no barriers to aluminum. So it's really stunning. So Chris Exley, I think I've been writing him, trying to hook him up to some of our breast surgeons and try to do more studies, because one of his hypotheses is that the microcalcifications, which are one of the radiographic hallmarks of a cancer, is the combination of calcium and aluminum. Calcium and aluminum bind very tightly together. So they're trying to do that study to take one more step closer to showing aluminum may be inducing breast cancers. He also wrote another hypothesis paper. His concern was that sunscreen was causing skin cancers, which is, disturbing. we look at societies that have high cancer rates, and they probably have high sunscreen use rate as well. Australia, New Zealand, and so forth. So we're applying carcinogens. If we're applying aluminum to the surface of our skin, we're applying a carcinogen. Disturbing.
Well, there's so much out there, you know. And the thing is that we've seen this dramatic increase of the incidence of cancer from at the beginning of the last century, one in every 33 Americans died of cancer. Today, it's about one in every three or two Americans will die of cancer. Now, that's a dramatic increase. So what are we doing? Well, nobody's answered that question. We try to answer some of it, and we certainly know some of the answers. Certainly the milk products, are they directly related to it? The pesticides, the herbicides, the toxins that we take in have dramatically increased the incidence of all sorts of cancers. But what we need to do is learn what, you know, produces the cancers and then do the best we can to avoid it. To go right ahead, David.
So we were talking about the consumer products. And, you know, cooking with aluminum utensils and cooking in aluminum foil, probably not a great idea. Medicinals, antacids. Now, the antacids can change the pH of the stomach substantially. At some pHs, will have an enhanced aluminum absorption, and some studies have shown aluminum absorption up to 30% on individuals who are taking aluminum-containing antacids. So aluminum-containing antacids, probably a pretty bad idea under any circumstance. And there are alternatives. So, now the flu shot, which maybe not the greatest thing in the world for a lot of reasons, but aluminum, as far as I know, is not contained in the flu shot. But it is in the pneumococcal vaccine. And soy products is another pretty variable source. Now, aluminum was found in infant formulas, soy formulas, and just other formulas, heavily processed formulas, to a very, very high degree. And they have, I understand, regulated that a bit more and have tried to reduce the amount of aluminum. But aluminum is a contaminant, and you can't always necessarily control for that in the process. So,
what about aluminum cans, you know, and all the pop and other things that are in aluminum cans?
Well, again, I think it's a lot worse, and it may be just a relative degree, but the studies that I've looked at were mixed findings. That they didn't find, some studies found very little influence of the content of the can based on the aluminum of the can, but really it depends on the pH of that solution, the acidity of the solution, and whether there's ascorbate or citrate in the can. It would change the solubility of that aluminum substantially. So, we don't drink soda for a lot of reasons, but I think it just makes sense to avoid drinking any prepared food in any kind of aluminum-containing structure. But unfortunately, your option is what? Glass and lead and aluminum are contaminants of glass. So you can get it from a ceramic plate, you can get it from a glass bottle, but I think the highest levels are found in aluminum-containing cans.
What about, of course, the metal cans, you know, that used to be, that we called them tin cans, but they were, I think they were steel, they were lined with some sort of an alloy. Are those a lot then healthier than the aluminum cans?
Well, I don't know. I just simply don't know. Like I said, we filter our house water and we pretty much drink, what's in our refrigerator is pretty much water and milk right from the cow and right from the goat. So we've tried to clean up our diet as much as possible, but unfortunately in a fast-paced world, you can't pick that out of your refrigerator at work too easily. So it takes a lot of effort to clean up what you're exposed to. But it really is amazing when you think about it how much we're exposed to from day-to-day products. It to a certain degree is unavoidable, but our short list, nice short list of things to avoid is replace your toothpaste with a non-aluminum-containing toothpaste. Replace your underarm deodorant. It may take a little effort to find a deodorant that works well. It's a little bit more difficult, but you can find these at health food stores. And certainly no pouch drinks at all for children. No aluminum-containing antacids or buffered aspirins. Those, I think, are really the biggest offenders. But there's one study that I didn't get a chance to mention, and I think it's a really, really a key study when trying to link aluminum in vaccines to neuropathology. And this was published last year at the University of British Columbia by researcher Christopher Shaw. And I'm not sure if you heard any press releases on this. It would have been, I think, early 2007.
No, I haven't.
There was a few press releases on this, which surprised me. That's the first time I heard about it. Of course, aluminum really wasn't on our radar in these autism circles, so it just got passed around, and I downloaded the paper, and I didn't read it for quite a while, and I went back and revisited this, and it really, I think it's probably the paper, if the CDC is going to have trouble putting out this aluminum fire, which I think is going to build from here, this is the paper that's going to really hurt their efforts. Chris Shaw designed a study to take a look at the effects of aluminum in anthrax vaccine. They wanted to try to explain some of the motor problems they were seeing after the anthrax vaccine in Army recruits and people in the military. So they choose a mouse model, and they didn't do, they picked the appropriate age. They looked at young adult mice, and they gave them 6 shots of aluminum hydroxide, basically the aluminum salt in vaccine. And they didn't give them a real big dose. In fact, the cumulative doses these mice got was only about 60 mics per kilo. They got about 10 mics per kilo per shot, so about 6 shots of 10 mics per kilo. And again, that's lower than we give kids, clearly lower than what we're giving kids. And then before they sacrificed the animals to look at neuropathology, they did some standard testing, and they found some things that bothered them a bit. They found a reduction in their strength, and we know that from aluminum toxicity literature, hypotonia and muscle strength impairment are very prominent. So they found 50% reduction in strength in these aluminum-injected mice. They found increase in some anxiety testing, open field testing. They found some memory errors, a little bit. Nothing, they were a little bit concerned, but they were not really prepared for what they saw at autopsy. When they looked in the spinal cord of the animals, for starters, trying to explain the motor weakness, they found that the motor neurons were dying. In fact, the motor neurons in the spinal cord were reduced 35%. They looked at the motor cortex in the brain, and they found a 200% increase in apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. So basically, cells were dying in the brain, and they were dying in the spinal cord. It didn't occur in the control animals. It occurred only in the aluminum hydroxide injected animals, and they were shocked. They were appalled, and so they obviously made a politically correct statement in their paper and somewhat cautiously said, you know, we better do more long-term safety studies on this. This is quite a concern. We need to do more research before we deliver this adjuvant to the population through a vaccine program. And I don't think they really realized, because I've contacted them several times, how much children are getting. So this is pretty shocking.
And, of course, was this in the anthrax vaccine? Is the aluminum in the anthrax? Because there are all sorts of
there's a lot of things in the anthrax.
Right.
Squalene, right? I think squalene is in there. They did a group with aluminum hydroxide only, and they did that just because they wanted to control. They really didn't think this was the bad thing. And then they did the full-blown anthrax vaccine, which, of course, contained aluminum, and they found no difference. So the pathology and the behaviors they saw with the aluminum hydroxide only was no worse or better than the anthrax shot.
And so the hypothesis then was it was the aluminum in the anthrax that was creating the problem, not the anthrax the rest of the anthrax vaccine. Then.
That was their concern. That was their conclusion. This is an aluminum hydroxide problem.
And, of course, aluminum hydroxide has been in vaccines going all the way back to the 20s and say, well, you know, it hasn't done any harm. Look, it's been around all this time. Well, how do you know it hasn't done any harm? A lot of these children have real problems, and certainly the autism is a beautiful example. And they try to ignore this, but I don't think you can ignore this. Not when 1 in 60 boys is autistic and their life is destroyed.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And we have, now, I don't know if you've had Richard Deeth on your show.
No, I haven't.
Richard Deeth is a basic scientist, a bench researcher, brilliant guy at Northeastern University who's done some of the real hallmark work on thimerosal and the impairment of these methylation pathways that produce glutathione and so forth and impair the mechanisms of attention. He's actually an expert on the biomolecular pathway of attention. And he published this study a couple of years ago, and he looked at aluminum and mercury and arsenic and a few other toxins, and he found of course, these pathways, methionine synthase was the enzyme mostly impaired that produced a state of oxidative stress or cell stress. And this was a petri dish kind of a study. And he had some data he didn't publish, and I contacted him and I said, Dr. Deeth, I know you've tested aluminum in your study. And he underestimated how much kids were getting, and I gave him the cumulative doses that kids were exposed to. He went back and did some calculations, and he had some studies where he was running at the time. So he went up and now this is a very important finding. He's one of the key researchers that found a very key biomolecular marker in autism. And he found, and he hasn't published this yet, and they're doing the formal studies now, he said that the aluminum impaired methionine synthase exactly as bad as mercury did on an equal dose basis. And we know that there's about 20 times as more aluminum on a microgram basis in the vaccine as there is mercury. When mercury was in shots, it was only 25 mics per shot. But clearly it's a potent toxin, but there's up to a milligram on days of vaccine. So it looks like aluminum, it works in these pathways and does a lot more damage than even mercury does. So they're conducting some studies on that. And there's also another very interesting study that was just published from a Spanish group in Spain.
Well, David, before we go on, do you have a website people could go to get more information?
Well, I actually have my entire file posted after I lectured in Atlanta. I made it open source. So if people emailed me, I will send them the web link and they can download my entire resource file.
All right. And how can they have the email you?
My email is raypoke, R-A-Y-P-O-K-E, @mac.com.
raypoke@mac.com. And
right.
If you're interested in getting the information, David is, does a wonderful job of getting this information, putting it together, and certainly the sort of thing that scientists need as they begin looking at the aluminum as a cause for disease. We'll be right back. Well, David, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program, so you go right ahead.
Well, I think, going forward, we have to do a little more work, particularly with autism. I think when you think about it, a lot of the treatments that are targeting autism and are working so well aren't necessarily specific at mercury. They're treating underlying biomolecular abnormality. We could do a better job removing aluminum from children. There are specific chelators that, to my knowledge, have never been used in autism, and it's called DFO, or deferoxamine. It reversed Alzheimer's dementia that developed in dialysis, and it reversed the osteomalacia, which is the bone disease that developed on dialysis. So it's a very potent agent at removing aluminum. We are planning to do some chelation challenges in some children. I'm not a treating physician, but I'm working with a clinical practice that's doing this. And we believe that we can fulfill the Nephrology Society's diagnosis of aluminum poisoning by just doing these DFO challenges, because when we've done the EDTA challenge, which is a chelation agent mostly for lead, we found enormous amounts of aluminum coming out that basically fulfill these requirements of aluminum poisoning. We need to do a study with a control group, but I believe what I will be able to say, and whether it be 3 months or 6 months from now, but I think it will be inside of another year, we'll be able to say that there is a subset of autistic kids that are aluminum poisoned. And we hope that there is yet another specific manner in which we can detoxify, get out these metals in these children, and see if we can get an improvement in their problem.
Well, will this chelator take out both mercury and aluminum, or just aluminum?
No, DFO is pretty specific. It's actually approved to take out iron as an iron chelator, but it was used widely in aluminum toxicity cases, mostly on dialysis, so there's a lot of clinical experience with it. As I said, it hasn't been applied to autism, but a lot of the autistic kids get EDTA chelation, and that pulls aluminum too. It's just not as a strong binder of aluminum as DFO. So if we are able to identify now aluminum toxicity and treat it specifically, what we might have is a subset of kids that really can get dramatically better. And we hope that's one of the byproducts of this research.
Well, now, do some of the children really do quite well on the chelation?
Some do actually very well. And interesting, there's a number of things that really work well that are hallmarks of aluminum toxicity. Melatonin is one of the ways that aluminum works on the brain. It impairs melatonin secretion and production, and we see that in the majority of autistic children. And there's also a very high response rate to melatonin in autistic kids, not just sleep, but just overall improvement as an antioxidant.
Hold that thought for just a moment here, and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been David Aubin. He was just saying that a lot of these autistic children will benefit from a melatonin and getting the melatonin into them. Ordinarily, it's produced by I forgot, is it the pineal gland that produces the melatonin, isn't it?
Yes.
And, of course, are they giving them then melatonin supplements?
Yes, they're giving melatonin supplements, and predominantly they're giving it to them because of the high prevalence of sleep disorders. And you'll note that Alzheimer's is a very high prevalence of sleep disorders. Dialysis patients have a very high prevalence of sleep disorders, and known aluminum toxicity, there's a high prevalence of sleep disorders, so it's a pretty good match.
Well,
but it's an antioxidant, so not only, I think, are they getting benefit from melatonin that way, but it improves the cell's ability to get rid of its byproducts of oxygen consumption.
Well, I wish we could go on, but the time apparently has run out, so David, thank you. Our guest has been Dr. David Ayoub. I hope you've enjoyed this. His material on aluminum, I think it's vitally important, and I hope we'll follow along and keep looking over his shoulders as this whole basic information begins to open up, and hopefully we can do something about the epidemic of autism, which is affecting one in every 60 boys in America. What a terrible tragedy. David, thanks so very much for being with us.
Thanks, Dr. Stan. God bless you.
And you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, certainly if you'd like to hear Dr. Ayoub's treatise on thimerosal, we have that on a DVD, and with that comes a CD-ROM that will give you, hundreds, if not thousands of pages of research on thimerosal. Well, David's doing a similar study on aluminum, and aluminum is in most of the vaccines as part of alum, which has been put in there since the 1920s, when it was deemed to be a extremely toxic substance. Why would they take something so toxic and put it into our vaccines? And then, of course, we see so many of our children having very real problems for those vaccines. Well, certainly, if you'd like to get a copy of this evening's program, it is available. If you'd like to get the DVD of Dr. Ayoub talking about thimerosal, our number 1-800-544-8927. Vaccines are harmful. If you'd like documentation, certainly we suggest Neil Miller's book, which we carry on vaccines, Neil Miller's book on autism. Go to my webpage of radioliberty.com and pull down my articles on vaccines. You'll find out that most of the childhood vaccines, were not a major problem when they began to bring these vaccines in the 1930s and 1940s. And the incidence of death from childhood diseases had fallen dramatically and probably would have continued falling even without the vaccinations. But we're talking about billions of dollars of years of profit, billions of dollars of profit from the vaccine for the vaccine manufacturers. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, they have a get-out-of-jail-free card. You cannot sue a vaccine manufacturer for a complication from taking a vaccine. They're protected by federal laws, saying, well, if we can be sued, we're not going to make the vaccine. And look at all the children are going to die, and the children aren't going to die. That's the difficulty. The incidence of death from childhood vaccines was very, very small here in the United States before the vaccines were introduced. And you've never been told that, and most of the doctors don't understand that. But, well, we're going to have to get the information out. So, again, the book you want to get is entitled Vaccines by Neil Miller, his book on autism. You'll certainly want to get Dr. Sherry Tenpenny's book on vaccines, our four-tape set on vaccines. We have so much information available to Radio Liberty, and we don't have all the answers, but we've got a lot of questions. So please pray for America. Pray for revival, and pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because America is under attack today, and so are our children. is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for the survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views and the views of our guest. And this evening, our guest is Barry Shamish, who's an investigative reporter. He's an Israeli citizen. He is living here in America because attempts on his life in Israel. And we're going to be talking this evening, first few minutes, about what's going on in the Middle East, give you an update of what's going on, and then we're going to talk about Barry's book, The Return of the Giants, which is a subject which I think is very important, because what he's talking about are supernatural beings. At least this is what the story would appear to be. We've already done three interviews on his book, The Return of the Giants, and it'll be a fascinating program tonight. But right now, I think Barry wants to give us an update on what's going on in Israel. So, Barry, go right ahead.
I wouldn't normally begin this way, but it was an appalling week, and I just want to mention, one horrible incident. The army, the Israeli Defense Forces, met with the security chiefs of Yesha, that's Judea and Samaria, there's no more Gaza in there, and told them to prepare for a major operation where the army is going to look at all the weapons held by the citizens, the Jewish citizens of Yesha, for license violations. And they're going to take away, they say only the violated weapons, but that's not how the security chiefs of Yesha took the operation. They panicked, and the news got out to Channel 10 in Israel that this operation was going to take place where the weapons of the residents of Judea and Samaria are going to be confiscated by the army. Now, normally, I suppose, in the old Israel, you wouldn't suspect the worst. But in the situation that exists today, people just think they're being disarmed, which they are, by the way. I mean, they've reached the conclusion that they are being disarmed, and I've gone through the show on the secret clause of Oslo, which I was fortunate enough to have leaked to me in December of '93, where disarming the settlers was going to be the last act before massacres took place and the settlers voluntarily, supposedly, abandoned their homes. Now, what's extremely worrying about this new operation, it hasn't gone into actual action yet, but it's certainly very, very close to going into action when you meet with the security chiefs and that. Actually ask them to be on your side, if you can believe this, because Israel has permitted Russian armored personnel carriers, APCs, to be sold to the Palestinian Liberation Organization.
Why would the Israeli government allow a terrorist organization to get the armored personnel carriers?
Well, again, the answer is too shocking for most people to understand, but the Israeli government is determined to see the country go. I mean, this is a combination of ideology and blackmail, I suppose.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Barry Shamish about what's going on in Israel today. Go right ahead, Barry.
All right. I've always been confused. I await a commercial and there isn't one. But okay. What we've got Initially, there was supposed to be 50 of these APCs, armored personnel carriers, they're called, sold to the Palestinian Authority. And now there was so much objection from the IDF to give the enemy this first-rate armored personnel carrier that the government has decided to only permit 25. I strongly suspect that 25 was the figure they were going for, and they started off a little high, and the compromise was a bunch of baloney. They're getting exactly what they wanted by upping the stakes at the beginning and looking like they're compromising. But if you have all these settlements, and settlements are a weird word for actual towns. Some of these towns are not just settlements. Baalei Adamim has 30,000 people in them. And so settlement is kind of a silly word for a city of 30,000 people. Nonetheless, if the citizens are disarmed and the enemy have armored personnel carriers, they can walk in anywhere. One little machine can take over the town of 30,000 unless you've got some very strong anti-tank missiles. You can't stop an armored personnel carrier. It's got 8 inches of steel. Even if you are armed with light weaponry, it's not going to help you. I'm not sure if you've been in one, but I have. These are not the kind of vehicles that anything but an armed force can stop. And what you've got now is a scenario that's just so gruesome. A disarmed population, and the enemy has 2007 Russian armed personnel carriers. The residents don't have a chance against this. And this happened this week. I thought I'd mention that before we do our show, just because it's such a dire turn of events, as if everything wasn't. But this is a really bad one.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with Barry Shamus to explore another subject, but I think people have to ask yourself, why is the Israeli government releasing terrorists? And we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry is simply pointing out that the Olmert's government is going to give 25 armored personnel carriers to the Fatah, which is a terrorist organization dedicated to the destruction of Israel. And supposedly, they're the good terrorists in contrast to the bad terrorists, which is Hamas. But it really doesn't make sense in a similar manner. Why would Israel be continually turning terrorists loose? And they here they'll turn 20 terrorists loose, and there 400 terrorists. This is the last release. Why would you release terrorists, people you know you're going to have to fight? It doesn't make sense unless you understand that there are people within the hierarchy of the Israeli government who intend to betray Israel. And in a similar manner, there are people here in the United States who are actively funding communism in both Russia and in China. I mean, the reason that China is a communist state is because the American State Department back in 1949 and their policies, and the reason that Russia is a major force in the world today. 10 years ago, Russia defaulted on its loans, didn't have enough money to pay its international debts. Today, it is one of the wealthiest nations in the world with over $440 billion in reserves. And, of course, how did it happen? Why? Foreign aid from the United States and help from American oil companies, Exxon, and then, of course, both the Royal Dutch Shell and BP, British Petroleum, were over there, each with a $20 billion contract, funneling money into Russia, and then help from the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, from the Asian Development Bank, and, of course, from a number of other U.S.-funded agencies that drill the oil wells for Russia, drill the gas wells for Russia, built the oil and gas pipelines for them. Why would we do something like that? Well, for the same reason that Israel, the Israeli government, is giving Fatah 25 armored personnel carriers. Nothing is it appears to be, and most Americans and most Israelis have no idea what's really going on. And if you'd like to verify what I just said about Russia, it's covered in a little pamphlet we put together called the Communist-Capitalist Alliance. Communist-Capitalist Alliance. You'll get all the documentation on how we have made Russia one of the wealthiest nations in the world. And we did it in 10 years with your tax money, largely, ladies and gentlemen. Go right ahead, Barry.
All right, now to the subject you requested I speak about. I think it's a good idea. That's my book, Return of the Giants. Let us begin with two crop circles. They're not circles. They're beyond circles. They're formations. But the year is 1997, and in those days, I had a great deal more response as a researcher of this aerial phenomenon than actually the Rabin assassination, at least outside Israel. And I did a program that I should mention. They did pay me, but I was always mad at them because in the show itself you just see me roaming around and instead of being interviewed, which I was for hours. It's a show that was on the Discovery Network. It was called Giants, the Mystery and the Myth. And I was their guide, and I gave them some mighty good people to talk to for the show, but I was excluded. So I've always been kind of a little spoiled about this. But nonetheless, we'll talk about Beit Sarzir briefly. I took their crew to meet Golan Masrin. Now, he's an Arab. I believe he's a Druze in retrospect, but I'm saving the Arab testimonies for some future show. They've got a very strange phenomenon as well at the same time. Now, on the first night of Passover in April of 1997, a neighbor of Golan Masrin saw little lights in their wheat fields and told him about it. And Golan went and investigated, and there was a crop formation. What it looked like, an umbrella. What it comes down to, there were two quarter circles on either side of a straight line. The diameter, that is the length from the outer tip of the quarter circle to the line in the middle was 25 kilometers. So it was about meters, I'm sorry. So it was about 50 meters, two quarter circles on a line. It looked like an umbrella. That's the best way you can describe this this formation he found in the wheat fields. Now, on the night of these little lights, the dogs were barking wildly, and something had happened to wake the people up, and they had seen the lights. But Golan was the one who actually found the circle the next day. Now, in talking about the Arab reaction to this, there were some mighty weird, very, very weird incidents involving Arabs, and in future show we'll talk about this. But I found Golan to be a very sophisticated young man, and he reported this.
Now, basically, was this a wheat field? Was this a cornfield? What were they growing in the field?
It was wheat.
It was wheat, okay. And so a wheat field, and basically you're talking about these crop circles, but this wasn't a circle. This was an umbrella that somebody, or at least this impression, that tromping down or pushing down the corn in the cornfield. Go ahead.
Well, the wheat.
Oh, the wheat, okay, wheat.
Right. I suppose there's a difference, but we'll go into that shortly. But Golan reported this to the police, and it made the media. And a friend of mine, Gil Barr, who I worked with, he was just a young guy then. He was 17. And we'll get back to Gil. He, a brilliant young kid, by the way, became my partner and in a number of incidents, including the next one we'll speak about. But he went down and he saw the formation. There were seven pods. He calls them pods. I would just call them holes. But there were seven holes in the middle of this formation, and we had just filmed sightings, and Gil was interviewed, and we'll talk about that shortly. He filmed a UFO over Rishon LeZion at 4 in the afternoon being chased by an Israeli jet. It's a remarkable film, and it's on my DVD, but little by little, Gil went and met Golan, and he took photographs and measurements, and he found materials in these holes. These holes are about 6 centimeters in diameter and about the same depth, and in 4 of the holes there was a white powder, and in 3 of the holes there was a red oil. And he sent them to W.C. Levengood. He's a physicist who worked for sightings, and Nancy Talbot, his partner, and to be tested. It was a very unusual crop formation, but there's more to it than that. On the night that this thing was being formed, that was the first night of Passover, the residents of this town, Beit Zarzir, reported giants in their houses. And not the same giants as were seen in Kadima. Golan started talking a little about this because the town was really spooked. And
well, I suppose if I found a giant in my home, I'd be a little spooked too. What do you mean the giants that were in the homes?
They were glowing. The way he described it is that they were phosphorescent or fluorescent, glowing, translucent. 7-foot giants.
The translucent 7-foot giants, okay.
That's what the town saw.
Right.
And Golan had one in his house. And nobody was talking about this. And believe me, to get an Arab to talk about something this weird is not so simple. They've got enough problems with Israelis believing they're superstitious and a little backwards, and they don't like doing this. This is not something they like to admit to. But Golan was a very sophisticated young man. His explanation to the camera was extremely good. And he said, and by the way, this lasted probably for a couple of weeks, where the townspeople would just lock their doors at night in terror that these translucent, 7-foot glowing giants would be in their homes. It terrified the town of Beit Zarzir. And this, well, we have it on film at least. And the Discovery Channel actually broadcasted him. And I was very impressed by him as well. He was well-spoken. Clearly he had nothing to gain by talking about this incident. Nothing. Not money, nothing. He wanted some sort of truth to come out, and he told what he saw, and that was in the Jezreel Valley is where the town of Beit Zarzir is. Oops, I hear the music.
All right, fine. Well, we'll be back with Barry in just a moment or two. We're talking about his book, Return of the Giants. Now, this is all in the book, but this will be the fourth in a series of radio programs that we've allowing Barry to tell the story. And, of course, the other stories are even more bizarre, and yet they were all occurring associated with the Oslo Accord, almost as if God was warning the people that this was not part of his plan. Go right ahead there, Barry.
Well, again, as I watch this from close up, And again, I was filmed for television, Discovery Channel, Fox TV, and Sightings, which was on NBC in those days. I was getting, you know, not a, a little bit of publicity. It was a shame Rabin didn't get the amount of publicity these UFOs got. But let's call that the end of Bates Arzier, but there's a related incident that I was certainly a part of, and that happened on Rosh Hashanah evening. And I repeat from previous shows, these Israeli incidents all happened on the Sabbath or on the evenings of major holidays. And you can never figure out that one. You just can't. But in the Jezreel Valley, we go from Passover evening to Rosh Hashanah evening, and Rosh Hashanah evening, we now go to Tel Adashim. I'd say it would be 10 miles from Beit Zarzir in the Jezreel Valley. It's about also 5 miles, I note, from Har Megiddo, a little mountain which the name Armageddon comes from. So there's your biblical references, whatever they mean, they mean. Now, Tel Adashim was discovered by someone named Safrir Meisel, who was driving home. There was a something of a hill. It was enough of a hill to see the town cornfield. It was quite an extensive cornfield, as a matter of fact. And he saw a formation, but a very big formation, inside the cornfield. And this was hidden from the road. It was hidden from the public. No one could see this thing. You had to have been in the right spot on the right hill. Nonetheless, he reported to the police, and the police was monitored by Reshet Aleph, a radio station in Israel. And so the word became a little bit public, not very. It was Rosh Hashanah evening, and not many people were listening to the radio. But Safir told a neighbor, and the neighbor told someone named Yossi Oren, who knew me, and he also knew Gil Bar. So Yossi phoned me up and said, do you want to see a really, really big crop formation? I haven't been there yet, but I talked to Safir, and apparently this thing is really big. And this was in the morning. It was Rosh Hashanah morning, the first day of Rosh Hashanah. My kids were at home. One was 6, one was 5. And I said, sure, I'll take the kids to see a crop formation. My poor little kids, they grew up prancing through fields looking at these things. And so I drove to Tel Aviv, where I met Yossi and Gil Bar. I drove down to Rishon. I picked them both up. And then we drove to the Jezreel Valley, about an hour and a half away. And we parked the car. We met Safir briefly. He showed us where to walk in. It was past a grove of trees. And then the grove ended. We were in the cornfield. And we were in, you've never seen such an impressive formation as this thing was. My children, little
hold,
kids...
Hold that thought for just a moment, Barry. All right, well, Barry is describing a crop formation. And, of course, these are these crop circles that people talk about. And, of course, if you read the occult literature as I do, they show lots of pictures of these all over the world. But this one is in the Jezreel Valley. It's not too far from the Tel Megiddo, where they always take the tourists. We've been there a number of times. Supposedly Solomon had his stables there at one time, and it's a key area. You stand there and on the edge of Tel Megiddo and look out over the Jezreel Valley. And what is this, 4 or 5 miles from there?
Yeah, about.
All right, fine. So it's a beautiful, lush valley in front of you. And, of course, this is where the Christian believe that the Battle of Armageddon will be fought. Well, anyway, of course, one of the Jewish people had actually seen this crop circle, and Barry was now invited to go, and he's taking his son and his daughter, 5 and 6, out to see the crop circle there in the Jezreel Valley. So go right ahead, Barry.
Well, we step into this, out of the grove, and into this magnificently weird circle. First of all, the corn really was high as an elephant's eye. I mean, this was 8-foot-tall corn, and it was crushed. And in some places, there was counterclockwise swirls. In other places, the corn was just flattened. Now, the first thing my children go in there and they literally, in Hebrew, say, ooh, ah. And they're stunned by this thing, and so was I, by the way. I'd never seen anything. 8-foot-high walls of corn, and then this swirled and flattened formation. Now, the first thing I do is I tell my children, you look on the ground and pick up anything unusual, anything. We had previously picked up shards of silicone and weird oils in Kadima that was the mode of these circles, but this wasn't like a Kadima circle. This was something very different. And we measured this thing. We brought a tape measure, and it was 50 meters. Now, here's what it looked like, and we really didn't know it. It took us about an hour to figure out what we were walking in. Try and imagine two wings. At least we thought they were wings. Later on, I got smart, and I figured out what it was. But it looked like two wings, about, as I said, 50 meters, half a football field, 25 meters each. In the middle, there was on top of these two wings, there were two half circles, flattened out as well. And they were from the tip of one to the tip of the other, about 25 meters. So we took a piece of paper and we drew the dimensions of this thing, and then we went looking at the corn, and we made a lot of wrong assumptions. The corn we found oozing and half eaten, and we gathered it, and then later on we met the farmers. They said, "Nah, that's just old corn. There's nothing unusual about that." In fact, we found no materials whatsoever, and the corn itself wasn't in essence damaged, except in the swirling area where something was swirled counterclockwise. The corn was knocked right off its stalks, and that was basically the day. We didn't find anything. We took good pictures. They're in my book, Return of the Giants. And my kids had a day. To this day, they don't forget. My daughter was visiting me a month ago. To this day, she never forgot walking in that formation. It left such a powerful impression on her. But on the way home, I'm very tired, and we pull into a restaurant. There's a Jewish restaurant on the road, and we had a fine meal. And I said, "People." We tried to figure out what they thought it was a landing site. They thought some sort of ship landed in there, and this was the actual shape of the ship. And I said, "No." I said, "You know what I think we're seeing? We're seeing this ship in profile. In other words, look at the drawings we made. We're seeing the side of a UFO, and the wings aren't the side of the wings so much as the side of, well, imagine a cigar-shaped UFO. It's not actually cigar-shaped. You're just looking at it from the side. It's actually round."
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment with Barry Shamish. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Barry Shamish. Go right ahead, Barry.
Well, in essence, we spoke about Amichai Akrai and the Shigbona Beach burnings, where twice a ship burned itself on the sands of Shigbona Beach for all the Israeli and world media to see. I said we've got the same thing here. We're looking at a side view, a profile of a ship, and what we're seeing is the shape of the ship. No matter how it was done, that's what we were walking into. And as we were sitting and getting the meal and refreshing ourselves, they saw my lodger. That's what the shape was. Some ship left a picture of itself in this cornfield in Tel Adashim. And as I said, this is some way to bring up my children. They're listening to this conversation, and the kids are nodding too, that it makes sense. This is a picture of a ship taken from the side, and we've already seen that. But remember, in Rosh Hashanah of 1996, the same thing happened to Ami Akrai in the beaches of in Shigbona Beach. It was a year, in the Hebrew calendar, it was exactly a year since the ship was photographed. I don't even know what the word would be. The profile was flashed onto the sands of Shigbona Beach on Rosh Hashanah the year before. And I said to myself, I don't know why this is happening. None of us know why this is happening. But we were in there, we photographed it. Ami Akrai is now known worldwide. The photographs of his ship burning, for lack of a better word, are known in newspapers worldwide. Something is happening here. It has something to do with Jewish holidays. We don't know what it is, but we were a witness to something probably immensely important, of which we know nothing. I mean, that was my conclusion. We walked into something so much bigger than ourselves, and that was it. That was the Tel Adashim crop formation, and I do a whole chapter in my book, Return of the Giants, on Beit Zarzir and Tel Adashim, and the two formations of the year 1997 in the Jezreel Valley on two Jewish holidays. That's one of the chapters in my books. In my book, Return of the Giants.
And of course, I think it's significant it's on Rosh Hashanah. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry is just telling that these supernatural events usually will come along on a Jewish holiday. And here, this is Rosh Hashanah. It's a year since they've had one at the beach, and now they're in the middle of the Jezreel Valley, and they're seeing the same thing. Now, remember, Jezreel Valley is a long way from the beach. But it would appear that what they see in this, not crop circle, because it's not round, but where the corn is crushed down, it's almost as if somebody has left an imprint of the side view of some sort of a spacecraft. Would that be a fair conclusion, Barry?
A very good conclusion.
All right, go ahead.
Now, I'm going to stick with the with that year 97. There was a period of UFO videos, and there was a period where the TV stations were asking me to collect them. And I'm going to go over just a few of the videos that were brought to me and others that I chased down. And by the way, I have a DVD. All these videos appear in the DVD.
And I've seen the DVD, and it's fascinating. And of course, you will see Barry being interviewed a number of times by various television stations. Before we go on, Barry, why don't you go ahead and get your website out and tell people how they can get your book, Return of the Giants.
Thank you. Return of the Giants, you go to www.lulu.com. That's lulu.com. There's a space on top that says search right in my name, Chamish. That's Chamish. And you'll get to Return of the Giants. You'll get to other things, but lulu.com and then Chamish. And if you want the DVD, I'm going to leave you my cell number. I've had nothing but good reactions and good people phoning me. So you phone 904-501-7605. That's 904-501-7605. And I'll send you the DVD, and it won't cost you much. The website is GodBarryChalmers.com. If you write BarryChalmers.com, you'll get to it, but you won't find this subject in there. It's all politics. That'll do for now. If you want me, you'll get to me through the website. Now, let's go and look at the videos. Now, a lady came, a nice lady, her name was Shula, from Kibbutz Chatzor. That is in the south of the country, on the edge of the Negev Desert. It's not that far from Rehovot. There's a kibbutz called Chatzor. For 3 days in August of 1996, the whole town came out and watched certainly the most amazing UFO. In my opinion, this is the best UFO ever filmed anywhere in the world. And I want you to know it's on YouTube. And there have been 60,000 visitors to this UFO. It was shown on Fox TV with my explanation. This, me and the UFO have got 60,000 visitors in about 2 months with a lot of good comments about this UFO. Now, she showed me this thing. You have never, ever seen a UFO like this one. Never. Now, I'm going to describe the first night. Try and imagine something huge. And in the left-hand corner, it's illuminated orange. But the lights go on a lot farther than this left-hand corner. But what you see on the first night are two levels of what apparently are buildings, are windows. That's why many people call it the balcony UFO. That wasn't my invention. There are two levels. There's a straight line. There are windows above it and below it. Okay? They're orange. Now, above the topmost layer, there is what appears to be, and I believe me, it appears to be, one window with a being in black silhouette above it. Now, believe me, I use that very, very cautiously. But that's what it looked like. And Shula said that she took this amazing, amazing UFO. It turns out that's not quite the case. What happened is on night number one, it was someone, a young kid, he was 17 at the time, his name was Amichai Shua. And he took the first night's video, told the rest of the kibbutz, and then the whole town was out there. For the next two nights, the whole kibbutz was out there. There were 60 to 100 people watching this being. I don't know what to call it. Call it a craft. It was tested. The films were tested. It was in the air. It's never been seen again. It wasn't a building. Whatever this thing was, Avichai filmed it for the first two nights. Then the battery ran out on his camera, and he borrowed Shula's camera for the third night. So I gave most of the credit to Avichai Shua for discovering it and filming it, even though it was actually Shula's camera on the third night. I give her some credit, but Avichai was the discoverer of this thing. Now, what is remarkable about the second and third night, you can see inside the windows. They're not windows, square windows, as we know them. They are off squares. And then I have no word, craft. Doesn't look like a craft, doesn't look like anything you've ever seen, but the camera goes right inside the windows. And I'm telling you, it looks like a skull. If you want to know what this looks like, it looks like a skull with two eyes and teeth. You have to get my DVD to see this. I cannot properly describe. Actually, you've seen it. Can you describe it?
No, I can't. But I remember being so impressed by the DVD because there was so much material on it.
Well, this was really the hit. This was the hit video because no UFO has looked like this. The camera goes in and in and in, and what can you say? You're inside those windows or vents. I think they might be vents. I don't know what they are, okay? I mean, I'm reporting this. I make no claims to know a damn thing about anything, really. I mean, this is beyond the level of my experience to know what this thing is. But what they did at Kibbutz Katzor, which is remarkable, is that they got the whole craft in daylight. There wasn't a lot of daylight. It was set up. Before the sun actually came through and the thing disappeared, you had a few minutes of the actual craft in daylight. And this craft was a monster. Now, I went on TV. This was Fox TV, primetime TV. And they said, Mr. Chambers, you have noted that this was over a major Israeli airbase. Could it have been military? And I just said to them, if it's military, how come it has never been seen ever again anywhere in the world since that night, since those three nights? And said that's some. And I said, I was in the Air Force. I was on these bases. I don't remember recalling a secret section of any Air Force base having a monster like that in it. And, well, it wasn't military, and it wasn't earthly either. Whatever this thing was, it's a genuine mystery. Now, that is the famous Kibbutz Katzor UFO. And I brought, Shua family, I brought them from sightings, but twice. I brought them in from Fox TV. They got a lot of fame out of filming this thing. It is one of the world's most mysterious UFOs, and there is no explanation. There's not an explanation for anything, what it comes down to. Now, I'm going to go through just some of the UFOs. I keep explaining, and I'm not joking about this, what happened in Israel didn't happen in other countries. And what makes it weirder, it didn't even happen in countries next to Israel. If these things were spotted in Syria, I'd be a lot happier. But they were just spotted in Israel. Now, we mentioned Gil Barr and how I got to know him. I got to know him because he filmed at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in Rishon LeZion. I believe the month was January. I believe it was winter. Nonetheless, you see a UFO just very much like the Katzor UFO. It was a disc, but it was being chased by an Israeli jet. And you watch the UFO do circles around the jet. Now, Dr. Stan, you watched that, of course.
Right.
Was that impressive?
Oh, well, the whole thing was impressive. This is why I mentioned to people I think it's worthwhile getting. I mean,
well,
I've never seen anything quite like it. I've never seen so many, so much footage of UFOs.
There's never been a country that's been so bombarded by them. And there are countries, well, America, that have lots of good reports, but how often do you film a jet and a UFO interacting? In the middle of the day, no less. 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And this is what Gil did. He actually filmed a jet and a UFO. Well, the UFO doing circles around the jet. The jet didn't have a chance. But he got on tape. And so that's how he got to know Gil. And we became very, very good partners in this UFO project. He was a great partner. And again, without Gil, I wouldn't have got to Tel Adashim, and, you know, it was very good to make friends in this field. Now, are we there?
Yes, we're still here, Barry.
Oh, good, I heard a beep. Now, I was also friends with David Ronen, and he had a column in Ma'ariv, in a section called Zman Tel Aviv, Tel Aviv Times. And it went throughout the country. He actually had a UFO column. There were so many UFOs in Israel in 96, 97, that Ma'ariv, the second biggest newspaper, gave him a weekend edition column on the latest UFOs. And that brought out so much material in Israel. The publicity of his column just brought them out from every which way. But David gave me a call and said, look, I've got the most remarkable set. It's a two-video set. And you're not going to believe this because it's just never been filmed before. What he did was show me two UFOs in battle, apparently in battle, because one knocks down the other. And by the way, clearly knocks down the other. I remember when I got the two tapes, I sent it out to America to something called MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, to let their labs look at this. I've shown it worldwide. It draws oohs and ahs wherever it's shown. There is a UFO. First of all, 6 months earlier, he's an immigrant from the former Yugoslavia. From his balcony in Rosh Ha'ain, which was about 50 miles from where I lived in Modi'in, he saw two lights. He filmed two lights in the sky, and both lights seemingly drop another light. It's like a chicken hatching an egg. And suddenly there's four lights in the sky. And they don't fall like flares, and they don't explode like flares. They're just in the sky. 6 months later, you have the same white object in the sky. And by the way, this is no star. It's a lot bigger than a star. And then suddenly, another object appears from the left and makes a beeline for this object, and it explodes in the middle of the sky. There's now it hits it. The one on the left makes the beeline, hits the object sitting in the sky. There's an explosion in the sky, and then there's no more UFO. And people went looking for shrapnel. There's no shrapnel. And I showed this on the Fox TV special, and I said, this could not have been a physical event. I said, there was no shrapnel. In the sky above Rosh Ha'ain, something exploded, but when it exploded, it didn't create a physical effect. This was some sort of, I don't know, energetic, metaphysical, something. But it wasn't a physical explosion. But it was an attack between two, well, I'm just going to say UFOs, for lack of a better word, unidentified flying objects. Whatever they were, for the first time anywhere in the world, we had them apparently dogfighting captured on video. And that, needless to say, is on my CD-ROM. I'm sorry, my DVD. Now, this DVD has a collection. It's not a Hollywood DVD. It isn't. I make no claims for that. These films are amateurish. And my editing isn't so great, but there they are. You can actually see this attack of the two UFOs over Rosh Ha'ain, something just not captured anywhere in the world. But it gets stranger. Now, by the way, I'm going to bring this up. I received three magazines from Italy, from Gianfranco Esposito. I met him when I spoke in San Marino 2 years ago. And I gave him my video It wasn't DVD in those days. It was just a video. And he ordered my book from Lulu. And he's done a series of articles about Israeli giants. Now, I don't read Italian, but the graphics and so forth are exceptional. In Italy, I'm still like a real big star there.
Well, our guest is, of course, has been Barry Shamish. We're talking about his book, Return of the Giants. And what he's really describing are metaphysical, entities. And, of course, this whole thing dealing with the UFOs, I'm firmly convinced, is a metaphysical manifestation of another dimension. I believe that there, and of course, if you read the writings of the people on the other side, they will tell you about the other dimension that they are in contact with. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Go right ahead, Barry. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up.
I've got a whole list of these videos. How much time do I have?
You got 3 minutes.
All right, I'll end up with one remarkable video, and we'll call it a night. That is the video from Nachum Shomroni. It was filmed in November of 1997. In downtown Tel Aviv, he lives in what is called North Tel Aviv. You may as well just call it downtown nowadays. He filmed, to the background of building noises and city noises, there was an attack of a UFO nobody has ever seen, I don't think. I know Japanese television tracked me down all the way to Vancouver earlier this year so that I could send them this film, and they paid me $500 for it. It's worth something. Imagine flying brains, sponges. I call them flying brains. Other people have called them flying sponges. There were about a dozen of them. On my DVD, you'll see them flying in twos and ones. But in downtown Tel Aviv, while people are busy and pile drivers are slamming in the sky, they were invaded. I just don't know. Maybe there was a craft inside these, I don't know, mists or hazes that were shaped like a brain, with a brain cell, an imaginary neck. I can't describe how weird these things were, but they were attacking downtown Tel Aviv in the daylight. People, here's my phone number if you want this DVD. It's 904-501-7605. That's 904-501-7605. And these DVDs are also in my book, Return of the Giants. Go to lulu.com, write in Chamish, that's Shamish, and you'll get to them, and you'll see them for yourselves. Next time we do Return of the Giants, I'll tell you about the actual alien that was actually filmed in Ramat HaKayel. I was saving that for last.
All right, fine. Well, that'll give us something to look forward to. Our guest, of course, has been Barry Shamish. He's talking about his book, The Return of the Giants. And here it's between about 85 and well into the 1990s, where we see this series of events that have no logical explanation in Israel. And, of course, this is all associated with the signing of the Oslo Accord. Barry, good night. God bless.
See you tomorrow. Bye, all.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest has been Barry Shamish, and we're really talking about these supernatural events that took place in Israel from about the mid-1980s up until the 1990s, but they had already begun about the time of the signing of the Oslo Accord, which, of course, was a plan to give Israel, to destroy Israel, basically, by simply giving land for peace, and the more land you gave, why, the less peace you got. So what were these things doing? What was their significance? Well, I believe that they are UFO manifestations. We have a wonderful book on UFOs that manifests my concept of what this is. These are supernatural events. They are something that bridges the situation between the other dimension and the dimension which we live. The book is called Alien Intervention. That's Alien Intervention. We have a book called The Gods That Walk Among Us, and another one called Supernatural. They're both by Tom Horn. Tom Horn's two books, The Gods That Walk Among Us and The Supernatural, we recommend them. Tom Horn has another book, Stargate. That's the Stargate. We carry that because we think it's important. The Stargate is the gate that separates the dimensions, and actually there are people who have actually tried to build a Stargate and pierce the other dimension. What is in the other dimension? Well, this is where the great battle that is being fought for the survival of mankind is being fought. And to understand that, you really need to hear my talk on the Forbidden Secret. Of course, you need to read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, which will take you into the secret societies that tie into the other dimension. And then my talk on the Forbidden Secret, and there's a syllabus that goes with that, will give you tremendous insight into the fact there has been a secret that has been passed down through the secret societies and the priests of the secret societies and down through the ages, and of course in more modern times from Gnosticism into the Templars, into the Rosicrucians, and into modern day Masonry, and of course the Theosophists, and so many of the organizations that exist today are continuations of the ancient mystery religions. And you'll be introduced to them in my talk, The Forbidden Secret. Then we also recommend certainly the video, very professionally done, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning and Riddles in Stone. To begin to put these things into perspective, we have a DVD that was made at our conference a year and a half ago. It was called The Atlantis Connection, because everything that's going on today has to do with ancient lost Atlantis and the belief that America one day would become the new Atlantis and lead the world into a one-world government, a one-world religion with a one-world leader. And then, of course, we have the other DVD that was made that year called The Emergence by Constance Cumby. It's about the one-world leader. Who is he? Well, we think it's a very important DVD, and then, of course, we have a four-tape set of my interviews with Constance Cumby. They are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. You get the interviews in either tape or on CD. So we hope that you'll want to get the material and begin to understand that there really is a spiritual battle going on for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And much of that battle is taking place in the other dimension. And, of course, we read about the other dimension. In the Bible, we're told we should not get in touch with mediums or fortune tellers or diviners or these people who are working out of the other dimension. Why? Because it's forbidden, and there is knowledge that is forbidden to us. And yet, of course, you have to understand that there are people who have accessed that knowledge and have gotten tremendous wealth and tremendous advantage by doing so, but unfortunately, they've pledged their entire souls for the advantages here on this earth. You need to get our videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll. Our number 1-800-544-8927.